You're listening to TheStreet.com's Real Story. Visit anytime for this and our other multimedia products.
Welcome to The Real Story, the show where we go behind the headlines, tell you what's really happening on Wall Street. And today is Tuesday, January 26th, and stocks could not hang on to their gains. Let's get to the numbers. Dow is down 3. It's been all day in the green, and it ended up down 3 to 10,193. S&P down 4 to 1,092. The Nasdaq down 7 to 2,203. Gold down a little over $2 to $1,093 an ounce. Oil down 64 cents to $74.62 a barrel. The 10-year, that was flat. It's now yielding 3.63. Apple, which had earnings yesterday, really blew it out, was up 1.4% to $206 a share. Great show today. All right, stocks could not hang out in the green today. They bled their way into the red. A lot of stuff to talk about, so we're going to fly through it and have some fantastic guests today. First of all, on a macro level, the Congressional Budget Office said this morning that the fiscal year ending this fall will see a $1.3 trillion deficit, roughly 9.2% of projected GDP. That's down from last year's $1.4 trillion. But however, it's still the second highest deficit as a percentage of GDP since World War II. So that's not good news. Amazingly, the bond vigilantes did not ride to the rescue and push rates higher, because we're going to be paying for this deficit. All right, let's keep going. On the good side, you say the consumer confidence index rose this month to 55.9 from 53.6. in December. That's from the Conference Board. Well, that might make some people feel better. That kept stocks in the green a little bit. Also, on the economic news front, the Case-Shiller Home Price Index of the top 20 cities rose 0.2% in November, below the 0.3% rise that was expected. Sorry about that. A lot of news on the housing front this week. Not all of it great. I want to read a little bit to you from Bill Gross, came out with his February investment note. A lot of it is just jibber jabber from Bill Gross. You know, a lot of these fund managers, they manage a lot of money, so they like to think really deep thoughts and quote Grateful Dead lyrics, Beatles lyrics. How come no one ever quotes The Replacements and Paul Westerberg? Maybe when I manage a lot of money, I'll do that. Anyway, he does come up with 3 points which I think are important at the very end of his very long investment letter. And it's worth reading every month because Bill Gross manages a heck of a lot of money. The very smart guy. I'm pretty sure he was the bond fund manager of the decade, of the century, of the millennium. Anyway, he says, given enough liquidity, concurrent yields, I would prefer to invest money in Canada. Its conservative banks never did participate in the housing crisis, and it moved toward and stayed closer to fiscal balance than any other country. You see, I just gave you the U.S. deficit, and he says, oh, Canada. Also, he says, Germany is the safest, most liquid sovereign alternative, although its leadership and the EU's potential stance toward bailouts of Greece and Ireland must be watched. Think AIG and GMAC, and you have a similar comparative predicament. This is something I've been saying for a while. I don't know whether or not the EU is going to let Greece and Ireland go under. We're going to find out. And it's funny how countries act as companies to a certain extent. And then finally, he says, the UK is a must to avoid. Its gilts are resting on a bed of nitroglycerin. High debt with the potential to devalue its currency present high risk for bond investors. In addition, its interest rates are already artificially influenced by accounting standards that at one point last year produced long-term real interest rates of 0.5% and lower. You know, once again, it's a question I've been asking is, how come rates are not higher for a lot of the developed nations, including the U.S., and he's asking that about the U.K. So, short some British bonds. I've been saying you can short some Japanese bonds, Japanese stocks. I think the yen is going to get weaker, but that's just me. I'm not Bill Gross. Also, okay, another quarterly letter. This one comes from Jeremy Grantham. He's over at GMO. He's widely read. And once again, I like reading these letters to you so you don't have to read them yourself. I think it's important. He gave lessons learned in the decade, which I think he had a few good lessons. Well, before he gave his lessons, he said, this is his view of the market. He says, my view of the economy's future is boringly unchanged. 7 lean years. I still believe that after the initial kick of the stimulus, we will move into a multi-year headwind as we sort out our extreme imbalances. So anyway, he's not that positive going forward. Here's a few of the lessons he learned in the decade. I'll give you a sprinkling of them. The Fed wields even more financial influence than we thought. Maybe that's why Congress is, this is my parenthetical, maybe that's why Congress is really going at the Fed right now. They want a little bit of piece of that power. Low rates have a more powerful effect on driving financial assets than on driving the economy. He says, Congress is nearly dysfunctional, primarily controlled by large corporations and hamstrung by the supermajority now routinely required in the Senate. Government administrations can be incompetent for long periods. Well, that one we kind of knew. Poor leadership can really damage a country's hard-won reputation in a mere 10 years. His next point is, Obama is not a miracle worker, although we're going to find out on Wednesday night. We'll see if he can brew up some miracles during his State of the Union. Next, the leadership of major corporations can be very lacking in insight and competence on a fairly routine basis. So it's just not our political leaders who are troublesome. It's our corporate leaders. Next, the two time-tested investment tools, value, which is P/E ratios, and price-to-book ratios, and price momentum are now much more heavily used and not so reliable as they once were. Next, asset classes really are more inefficiently priced than individual stocks on average, and therefore offer greater opportunities for adding value and reducing risk. Next, developed countries, including the U.S., are past their prime compared with developing countries. It is indeed a new world order. And then a few other ones. Being a global policeman is expensive and somewhere between difficult and impossible. Yeah, we're learning that the hard way now that the Cold War is over. And then finally, he reiterates, the Fed learns no lessons. And he says, have a happy and prosperous decade. All the best. All right, I talk about a lot of these big thoughts with Rich Suttmeier. He's the chief market strategist over at Value Engine. We talk about Bernanke, who's up for reconfirmation, and the banks, which had a really rough day. People are worried about the banks and Obama going at the banks again in the State of the Union. Obama also, just to let you know, he says he wants a spending freeze, although it's in a very small portion of the budget. But I guess he is listening to the Tea Party folks and the folks in Massachusetts. So maybe they're learning something in Washington. We're going to find out. I did read that book, Game Change, this weekend. It's a great book. Highly recommend it. It's about the 2008 campaign. Obama looked very good throughout that book, even though he's looking bad now. Maybe he should read that book and think back to when times were great, when he was winning primaries and beating the Clintons, who did not come off so well in that book. John Edwards and Sarah Palin certainly didn't look good in that book, but it's a great read. It's kind of reminded me of the other great book that came out, was it last year? Andrew Ross Sorkin's Too Big to Fail. I had him on a few months ago. That was a great interview. Anyway, listen to this great interview with Richard Suttmeier over at Value Engine. Rich Suttmeier, if you were given the job as Fed chairman, what would you do?
My first thing I would do is explain why monetary policy has been so wrong and the mistakes that have been made so far in the 21st century, pushing rates too low, leaving them there too low, 1% in 2003, 2004, and now 0 to 0.25%. And my first step would say, let's make the funds rate 3%. I want to support the dollar, flatten the yield curve, and preemptively cut out the risk of inflation.
Would that smash the economy, though?
The economy's already smashed. This will help the economy because I want to give Americans on Main Street higher interest rates on savings and money markets. I have always said that the U.S. Federal funds rate should never be below 3%. You know, if you have 3% in money markets, you would have a lot of people with a little more spending power that depend on fixed income and are not willing to take risk in the market. So it would help the economy having a little bit of higher Fed funds rate.
Seeing as you're not up for the job, what do you think about Ben Bernanke? Sounds like he's going to make it. Do you agree with that?
Of course not. I mean, each of our three regulators have skeletons in the closet. And for Bernanke, just what did he keep secret with regard to the Bank of America Merrill Lynch deal? And every time he's asked in an interview in questions and answer, he can't even price the Bear Stearns collateral. To me, that's unforgivable. And, you know, his monetary policy decisions created bubbles in gold, crude oil, and stocks, etc. going to be reelected as the chairman of the FOMC this week because of the FOMC meeting, but being reappointed as chairman of the Board of Governors, that's the Senate's call, and it looks like he has enough votes to squeak by, Greg.
What's your view of the housing numbers? You got some housing numbers out over the past few days. What's your view?
Well, I was surprised by existing home sales going down nearly 17%.
That was a big number, wasn't it?
It was a big number. I mean, it seems like the 8,000 and 6,500 tax credits are not moving the needle like it did for first-time buyers going into November. And
did it just steal from future sales? Is that what happened?
Future sales, number one. But then again, there's a lot of people are saying, how am I going to even find the home I want to buy, get a mortgage, go to contract by April 30th? And then even if I went to contract by April 30th, I got to close by June 30th. And everybody knows there's more red tape, FHA, raising the requirements to get an FHA guarantee. Freddie and Fannie mortgages have raised the requirements to get a mortgage. And banks are very stingy with who they're going to lend mortgage money to, given the fact that the defaults and foreclosures continue to rise, Greg.
Well, you know, everyone blames the banks for not lending enough now, but it seems like it makes sense to me because they were giving out money to people with no docs back then, and now they're trying to actually operate as real banks, and they're getting bashed for it. It seems like they just can't win.
They just can't win, there isn't a single sector of the banking industry that's not have fault in this issue. I mean, everybody's talking about the big banks, but there are nearly 3,000 community and regional banks that are overexposed and speculated on construction and commercial real estate. And it's very tough for them to increase lending when they're choking on increasing bad loans quarter after quarter. And
is that why President Obama didn't go after the small guys with his bank tax? He's only going after the 50 big guys?
Well, I think the FDIC is providing enough of a tax on the small guys by all of them ponied up 3 years' worth of deposit insurance fund fees, which was due by the end of 2009. That was $45 billion drained from the banking system overall. And still, every week we have Bank Failure Friday, and we'll be whittling away that $45 billion. I think we're already under $25 billion, so we're going to run out of money by the time this year is over with the pending bank failures, Greg.
Let's talk about some of the banks that you say have hidden bad loans in your most recent piece. BB&T, Huntington Bank Shares, SunTrust. How dangerous is this?
It's dangerous from the perspective that these big regional banks, like the major Wall Street banks, they still have off-balance sheet trusts. And a lot of those toxic mortgage securities are trading, but they're trading at 15 to 20 cents on the dollar, and they're not yet recognized. And the FDIC has given a little leeway to banks saying, okay, we're going to phase in mark-to-market accounting over the next 3 years. So there's going to be the need to raise more capital, and these losses are going to have to be recognized. So we have not seen the damage from that in the quarterly results that we're seeing from the banking system. But
are you short these banks?
Those names, no, not in my model portfolio.
Which banks are you short now?
Well, they're some of the smaller ones, like Astoria Financial, First Midwest Bank Corp, Glacier Bank Corp, MB Financial, Old National Bank, Union Bank Shares.
And how's the portfolio doing now, just so our listeners can get an idea?
Well, we're up 7% on closed trades, and the open portfolio is up nearly 2%. But that's, you know, and that's difficult to do when you're trading in a market that's a down market, or has been an up market, pardon me, and you're still scratching out some money by, you know, having decent calls with regard to which stocks to short. But it's been tough in January because the financials have outperformed. And those, you know, when you're short financials and they're outperforming, that's tough. But I'm not as overweighted in financials as I had been. I was like maybe 16 positions were shorts in banks. Now it's down to how many did I list for you, 8 or 9?
Well, you're a tough guy. It's a tough market, and it takes a tough guy to overcome a tough market. Thanks for coming on The Real Story. Richard Suttmeyer, he's the chief market strategist at Value Engine. Thanks a lot for coming on The Real Story.
Thank you, Greg.
All right, let's fly through a few stock names here before the next interview. I gave you some macro stuff before. Apple, as you know by now, reported financial results, beat estimates, posted revenue of $15.68 billion and earnings of $3.67 a share. They sold 3.36 million Macs in the quarter, up 33% from a year ago, 21 million iPods, down 8%, and 8.7 million iPhones, up 100%. Not bad. And we're going to see, hopefully, we'll see the tablet tomorrow. We'll see what the tablet means to Apple, whether or not it's, you know, buy the rumor and sell the turtleneck. When Steve Jobs comes out with the turtleneck, whether or not you sell it. Next, Telabs. That stock was up 12% today to $6.61. They, in terms of revenue, they did $389 million, which was $2 million below the street. But its non-GAAP earnings number of 9 cents was 2 pennies better than consensus. They're also going to lay off 200 people. I guess Wall Street likes that. Stock was up. Corning was down 7 cents to $18.65. They posted sales that were $1.53 billion, better than the street's $1.45 billion. So it's nice to see them beating on the top line. They expect a mild recovery in the developed world and continued growth in China. People in China want flat screen TVs. That's good for Corning. Next, we're going to fly through these. Sirius, that stock was up 2 cents today. That doesn't seem like a lot, but it is when it's a 70 cent stock. So the stock now trades at 70 cents. They Lazard Capital analyst Barton Crockett picked up coverage of Sirius with a buy rating and a dollar price target. So that's a big move up from 70 cents. He says, quote, after surviving a close brush with bankruptcy in early 2009, SiriusXM has fallen costs, more than 18.5 million loyal subscribers accepting price hikes, entrenched growth via factory installs in most new cars, and limited debt maturities until 2013 when rising cash flow should make refinancing easy. But will Howard Stern stay? Or will he go to Clear Channel? That's what they're talking about in the New York Post. Either way, that's the deal on Sirius. Very, very popular stock. Next, eBay. We'll stay in Techland. eBay was up a buck, 1.56% today to $24.06. They're going to reduce a lot of listing fees starting March 30th. Company says the cuts more closely align eBay's success with its sellers. Good for them. All right, let's get to a stock. I had Ron Wainshaw on today. He is the chief executive officer over at Aircastle. Now, they own 130 planes, 130 or so, and they lease them out. And it's very much an economic indicator. If more planes are flying, there's more commerce going on. They lease their planes to shippers. And everyone watches UPS and FedEx, as we know, as an economic indicator. And if you watch the airlines are doing better recently, airline stocks, even though there's the old rules, you're never supposed to invest in airline stock. But anyway, I spoke to Ron Wainshaw about the Aircastle business, about what's going on in his company and his competitors as well. So take a listen and hear what he said. Ron Wainshaw, CEO of Aircastle. You own about 130 aircraft. You lease them out. How's business?
Business is actually pretty good. We actually have ridden through the downturn in very good shape. To give you a couple examples, our fleet utilization was 98% through the third quarter last year. Very few landlords, if you will, can say that. Our portfolio yields, meaning the rent versus the book value of the aircraft, hung in there pretty steady. And our cash bill, about $50 million from the beginning of the year.
And how is your customers' business? Because a lot of your customers are very good indicators for the economy. For example, shippers and the airlines.
Right. We have two types of customers, passenger airlines and cargo airlines. Passenger airlines, about 70% by book value of aircraft. They've actually turned the corner. The end of the summer probably saw that turning point for most places, although I would say in places like China, it's been much brighter picture than the rest of the world. For example, the Chinese airlines, year over year, probably grew about mid-teens last year. So it's not an even picture. In the freight market, the recovery is a much more dramatic one. And like you said, they're a much more concurrent barometer of the economy.
What about your competitors? Who are some of your competitors? Is GE Capital one of them?
Sure. GE Capital is one of the biggest players in the business. Most of our competitors are actually on the sidelines right now, which is one of the interesting things about the sector. We started the company about 5 years ago from scratch, and it was, like today, a very interesting time to buy aircraft. We're coming out of a recession, and there are great investment opportunities. The big difference today versus 5 years ago is that the big leasing players are on the sidelines by and large.
Are you buying aircraft right now?
We're starting to. We bought two aircraft during the year last year, and we started looking very actively. We think it's a terrific time to buy new aircraft.
Boeings or Airbus?
Both. It's price, but both make great products. Both are terrific. You know, what we're focused on are the most fungible aircraft, the most widely used aircraft.
Not too long ago, you had a lot of CEOs visiting Capitol Hill, and they had to raise their hands if they flew in on a private aircraft. And a lot of those companies actually sold their aircraft. Have we recovered from the glut of aircraft that were sold?
Big difference between that business and what we do. We own and lease commercial airplanes, what these CEOs probably had to fly after they got rid of their corporate jets. So the corporate jet market has taken a big dive. We don't play there. The passenger market has recovered, like I said. And I think the great measuring point for that is a deal we signed at the end of last year with South African Airways. They are the flag carrier of South Africa, one of the premier airlines in the region. We signed a deal to lease them six brand new A330s. These are roughly 300-seat aircraft. For them to sign up to that as part of their fleet renewal strategy is a sign of confidence that things have gotten better.
You mentioned South Africa. Previously, you mentioned China. Are these markets where you see the best opportunities for growth? And what about the developed markets like the U.S. and Europe?
The growth in our sector is going to be driven by the emerging economies. China is a big part of it. Africa is important. South America has been a very strong source of business for our sector and for our company. I think the growth there is going to be driven by the GDP growth, generally speaking, but also when you look at employments, somebody in China is going to fly on average once every 5 years right now. In the U.S., you're likely to fly three times a year. That discrepancy is not going to change overnight, but it just shows you how huge the potential is. In the U.S. and in Western Europe, the potential isn't so much for growth, but you have very old fleets. Anybody flying around the U.S. knows that. And so the replacement is the opportunity set there.
I just don't want to know how old, you know? That's one thing I don't want to know. There's a lot of debt associated with your business, and you carry over $2 billion in debt. You have over $100 million in cash. What are the debt markets like right now? Because that was one of the big scares which caused yours and everyone else's stock prices to fall in 2008. What's the debt markets like? Are you able to refinance easily? Are you able to get financing for your planes easily?
Well, I think the capital structure of the company is one of the strongest selling points about us. We're a financing business at the end of the day, and we are probably the lowest leverage of any of the aircraft leasing companies, about 61% in the third quarter versus assets. Most others are far higher. We have no debt maturities until 2013, and that's where the tough part is. The capital markets, the debt markets are coming back very, very slowly, but refinancing is the tough part. And basically, the banks, the institutional investors, are going to go first to the guys they're most comfortable with. We see a lot more interest in our company than we've seen in some time. And I think that's why we believe we can grow.
Here's one thing I don't understand, and maybe I'm just missing it. But for 2010, Wall Street says you're not going to grow your earnings or revenues from 2009. Now, if we get an economic recovery, it should mean some great growth for companies like Aircastle who are leasing planes. What's Wall Street missing?
Growth. Absolutely. That you've hit the nail on the head. We started to grow, we intend to grow, and I think we have the ability to. And that's what sets us apart from a lot of our competitors.
Ron Wainshaw from Aircastle, thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Greg.
Email me at Greg, G-R-E-G-G, .Greenberg@thestreet.com. If there's a guest you want to hear on the show, as you know, we get most of the major guests. Some great authors come to the show. Or if you have anything you want me to talk about on the show, just email me. Let's get to a few more stocks, and then we're going to get to my final interview with Mark Travis of the Intrepid Capital Fund. It's a five-star fund, so let's go through a few more stocks because it's such a busy earnings week. You know, everyone's focusing on Bernanke and Obama and the whole macro picture. What about earnings? I thought it was all supposed to be about earnings. They say that every year. Johnson & Johnson, which is what they call Johnny John on the floor. Yo, give me some Johnny John. Their shares were down 43 cents today to $62.79. Company reported fourth quarter sales and profit above expectations. but its forecast of profit was shy of analyst forecasts. International sales clearly outshone domestic sales. It's all about selling anywhere but in the U.S. Next, Nucor beat fourth quarter profit and sales estimates. That stock was down 1.27% today to 43.57. I guess they didn't just beat by enough, you know? Steel stocks have been doing really well over the last few months. And it's funny because it also came out in today's Nucor report that the stocks have been running up, even though as the CEOs of these steel companies say, things aren't that great. And the management over at Nucor said that the commercial construction and residential is showing, quote, little if any strength. And he says first quarter earnings as a result will be significantly impacted by inventory valuation adjustments while deferring details for a later date. Maybe they're just sandbagging it, but I don't know. Realistic guys. Next, Baker Hughes. That was up 5% today to $46.89. They reported fourth quarter sales and profit better than expected, lifted by increased horizontal drilling in the U.S. and improved mix of rigs in the Gulf of Mexico. Revenue fell 24% to $2.43 billion, ahead of the $2.32 billion expected. A lot of people saying there's an oversupply of oil out there. Oil just keeps falling. It's down another 64 cents today to $74.62. People kept saying that there were tanker ships offshore just holding so much oil because as the price kept up, it was just easier just to keep it out there. But you got to think that if things aren't that well in the economy and there's high unemployment, people aren't driving to work, they're not going to use gas and oil. Let's move on. Travelers was up 2.8% today to $50.26. Company handily beat fourth quarter profit estimates. That lifted all the insurers. The CEO, Jay Fishman, said the results were the best quarterly net income since the company's IPO in 2002. Good for you, Travelers. And finally, McDonald's. Mickey D's, American icon, golden arches and all that, was up 1% today to $63.78. A lot of positive comments about McDonald's. Still, even after the company on Friday beat profit estimates, today, yesterday was Morgan Stanley. He raised his 2010 earnings, and today it was UBS Securities analyst David Palmer who raised his price target to 72 from 67. He says the company's going to continue to gain market share. I don't know. I live on the Upper East, as you guys know by now, and I don't go to McDonald's, you know? I can get better burgers in the neighborhood and better pizza. I don't need to order Domino's. Nothing against Domino's, but you get some darn good pizza over at Mimmy's. Joe, Natalie, Mimmy's Pizza, he's giving me a thumbs up. All right, final interview. Mark Travis of the Intrepid Capital Fund, ticker's ICMBX. It's 5 stars. And as I was walking in here, he was on CNBC. So I got him first. Runs a great fund and has interesting names. He just doesn't come over to thestreet.com and start talking about Google and Apple. Not that they're not great names, but they're out there. See, the great thing about Mark Travis is he comes with some interesting names. I mean, whoever comes talking about Spartan Stores or CSG Systems, he does. So take a listen to this interview with me and Mark Travis. Learn some new names, something fun to trade. You get more of an edge in these things. Check it out. Mark Travis of the Intrepid Capital Fund, you're positioning your fund defensively nowadays. Why is that?
Greg, I believe that many in my industry focus too much on relative returns, which is their portfolio versus a specific benchmark. I would say 95% of my peers are really concerned about the S&P, the Russell, or some other respected benchmark that's very narrow. I focus on an absolute return of capital, and I think most people would do better if they focused on that than a relative performance. So I first and foremost want to return more capital to my shareholders at the end of every calendar year if possible.
Now, are you just fearing right now that the returns are not going to be as good as last year, or is there something on the horizon that you're fearing to say, you know, I better have more in bonds and stock at this juncture, because you can hold bonds and stock in your fund?
And cash. Greg, I would say that a lot of our success in the last 18 months were securities we purchased post Lehman's meltdown in September. So through the fourth quarter of 08 and the first quarter of 09, there were a lot of businesses that we term internally trading at discounts to intrinsic value. The definition of intrinsic value would be a private market value. Where would that business trade if a knowledgeable buyer and seller were to transact a trade? And so we talk internally in terms of discounts to, say, par or 100 cent dollar. Can we find a 60 cent dollar using conservative assumptions about discounted cash flows or asset valuations. And in this environment, a lot of the equities that we like, there are discounts, just not substantial ones. They may be an 80-cent dollar, 85-cent dollar, 90-cent dollar, which implies on a going-forward basis more muted returns. So I'm cautiously optimistic and a cautious bull, but I do think that returns for calendar 10 will be a little more, certainly more muted than they were last year.
Well, it's tough to top what we occurred last year.
Sure. Sure.
All right, let's talk about some of the stocks you like. One of them is Spartan Stores, ticker SPTN. Now, they are a grocery store operator in states like Michigan, where there's high unemployment. Why do you like this stock when there's so much trouble going on in that particular state?
Well, like I like to joke, at this juncture, it's hard to find securities people don't like. And if you have to pick a state that's really kind of a disaster area out of 50, it'd be Michigan. But one thing we know is, like my dad used to say about people, everybody's got to eat. And Spartan Stores is a distributor. It's also got some grocery stores that compete well with Walmart Supercenters. One thing that we've seen following the grocery industry, another name we own is Weis Markets. A lot of people are not going to go to the Supercenter, Walmart, for their beef and their specialty produce. They want to go into a smaller, cleaner store, and that's where a Spartan stacks up well.
And one of the last things people also give up is their cable TV, right? Another stock you like is CSG Systems, which does a lot of billing for the cable operators and the DirecTV operators. Tell me about that one.
Well, it's the security today is in the, I believe, in the $19 range. It's probably worth in the low 20s. They just got a contract with DirecTV. They do Comcast and other cable-type businesses. So it's an indirect play on that. Good free cash flow generator. The risk to us is that you have a fairly high concentration of customers. You know, probably 90% of the revenue comes from six customers. You lose one customer and the ground would tremble. So it's not a terribly large position, but a pretty stable business from our perspective.
Another stock you like is Rent-A-Center, ticker RCII. Why that one?
Well, that business is misunderstood in our view. We actually own the debt, and the debt was called. There's about 3,000 rent-a-center stores across the country. In this environment where credit is less available, people are going into those stores for, you know, whether it's a couch, a chair, a TV, a stereo. And I think there's been a cloud, particularly with the discussion of financial product reform or some potential legislation, capping interest rates and that type of thing. But it's a very good business. They've rapidly repaid their debt, as evidenced by the call to par of one of the issues we held. The equity today, we think, is worth several dollars higher than where it trades. And, you know, it's just a basic, boring business, which is very typical of our equity portfolio.
Well, sometimes the boring ones are the best ones. But yeah. Speaking of clouds, there's no greater cloud over America today than the healthcare reform. Mm-hmm. And two stocks you like, Endo Pharmaceuticals, ticker ENDP. They deal with pain, and a CR Bard, ticker BCR. They're big in urology, I'm pretty sure. You like these two. Why is that?
Well, again, I think the political process has created an opportunity where, you know, people are familiar with the name Percocet. I like to joke that, you know, it's a prescription for those that have lost money in their equity portfolio. But they also have a patch that specifically treats people with shingles. And we think that there's a material discount there. Another factor in its equity that we like, no leverage, so no refinancing risk, more cash than debt. In the case of CR Bard, catheterization tubes are not a product that are going to be likely legislated out of existence. And again, a share price that's in the maybe high 70s, worth into the mid 90s. Again, void of leverage. So no debt whatsoever.
Another way to ease your pain if you're having problems with your portfolio, Constellation Brands. The liquor manufacturer. You own the debt there. Why do you own that?
Well, the debt has actually been repaid pretty rapidly. The typical MO that I look for in the fixed income side of Intrepid Capital Fund are what I call lightly levered, and that to me means two times debt to EBITDA, our pre-tax cash flow, an interest chart where it covers his interest charges four to five times over. In the case of Constellation, their margins have improved, they've had some divestitures, and their leverage has rapidly been compressed over the last year. And we actually own the equity as well.
Mark Travis of the Intrepid Capital Fund, five stars. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, thank you, Greg.
Great, great real story today. I was fired up. Joe Natale's fired up in the booth. And I'm going to be back tomorrow. I think tomorrow's Wednesday. I even remember the date today, and I always forget the date. Tomorrow's going to be Wednesday, January 27th, my buddy Doug Mollenhauer's birthday, my roommate from college. Anyway, I'm going to be back, and I'll see you then. Thanks for listening to The Real Story.